Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Again, here at Radio.com in Boston, I'm Mike Mullaney. This is New England Lifestyles. And, you know, this is a challenging year, to say the least. Relationships have been changed and altered. You have moments like Thanksgiving, one of the classic American holidays. The thing that I always loved about Thanksgiving was that it was a day where you didn't have to go buy anything. You didn't have to go do anything. It was basically about eating and gratitude, which is wonderful. But this year, it's going to be very much changed. You know, there have been big fights. Well, I want to bring my family over. Well, how do we know they're not COVID infected? You know, there are so many questions. So joining me on the phone is a relationship expert and psychotherapist. Her name is Joni Childs, and she's the author of a new book called I Hate the Man I Love, The Conscious Relationship is Your Key to Success. Did you write this with my wife?
Everybody asks the same question. All these guys ask the same question. Let me tell you right off the bat, it is not a male bashing book. As a matter of fact, men can actually learn something about having a conscious relationship and making their relationship more meaningful. So read the book too. You'll enjoy it.
Well, let me ask you this. One of the things I've always found is that sometimes you feel like your partner is the, you know, even if you have a wonderful partner, you seem like, why are they mean to me? And I think to myself, well, maybe she just has to vent out some of her frustrations. And she's someone, I'm someone she can trust and be honest with, and she can vent without any fear of recrimination. So maybe that's the role I play, and I'm happy to do it.
Well, you know, we as human beings, we can have oppositional feelings coexisting simultaneously. So you can hate the person's behavior but love the person. So many times when I've heard women say, I hate him, he's a jerk, he's a blah, 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 I can't say the things that I've heard on the radio. But when I said, well, if you hate him, why are you with him? And the answer is always the same. Over 42 years, I've heard the same response. Well, because I love him. You know, and when he is not a jerk or blah, 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 we have fun. We're very compatible. We enjoy each other. So, and it's the same way with parents towards children and children towards parents and friends with each other, family members. There are sometimes you just feel so angry and so frustrated with your partners, your friends, your neighbors, your children, that you can feel the anger mounting up. There's even a song called I Hate You, I Love You. There's movies about it. So it's part of the human condition, Mike.
Well, it's the classic Joan Jett song, I Hate Myself for Loving You. It's just, you know, it's one of those things. It's but I, you know, when you spend so much time with folks, inevitably, you're not always going to not conflict, because it's just human nature that sometimes you're going to disagree on things. And this is one of those things where this year, you know, I know that there was a survey done by Ohio State University that found that 38% of Americans will have Thanksgiving with 10 or more people. And 79% say they're the only eating with people that live with them. It's altered things. Thanksgiving is very different this year. I mean, when it comes down to it, there are some real fundamental challenges in relationships where one partner will say, well, look, you know, we're all doing what's safe. Why should we limit things? And then other people might be overly cautious and say, well, how do you know unless everyone has a test? There's reason to be nervous this year, because this virus, especially for folks over 50, especially over 60, over 70, whatever it is, it can be deadly. How do you get through some of this conflict revolution about things that are so fundamentally important to people, like Thanksgiving dinner?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. Everybody has different ideas about to have or not to have, to go or not to go. That is the question. Something like Hamlet would say, to be or not to be. But, you know, it is around the corner, and you're right. It is about sharing gratitude, our blessings, and eating lots of good food or not. So what happens when couples have different ideas about not having Thanksgiving due to the pandemic? It's about how negotiating these differences, how you negotiate them. And a lot of it depends on the nature of your relationship. Was it a contentious, dysfunctional relationship before COVID? Or was COVID something that, like you said, spending all this time together 24/7, not having our usual routines and our rituals and having space, created a lot of difficulty? Whatever the reason is, if you have a if you have relational maturity in your relationship, and you have a conscious relationship and a secure attachment, chances are you can work this out very easily through communication, cooperation, and compromise. So you can, you know, conflict can be a friend as well as an enemy. It's how you handle it. And I'll just give you an example, Mike. My case, we have 23 members of our family.
Nice family.
Yeah, it's a large one. I have grandchildren. I'm 81 years old, so I'm one of the ones that are at risk. And my ex-husband, he's the father of the five children. So it, this Thanksgiving, we'll have 23. We would have had 23 people. We have never, ever once missed a Thanksgiving together, even when my kids were little. Thanksgiving was something I always did, and 6 years ago, I handed it over to my daughter, one of my daughters. She's been doing it for 6 years. And we look forward to this because the family gets together, we have fun, we talk about what's going on, we play board games, we sit around the table and just communicate and chat. And this year is different because of the pandemic, and it is a challenging year. So we did a democratic way. We took a vote, and we'd all decided, what do we want to do? And it was easy because there was a consensus. It was unanimous. Everybody said, let's Zoom. Let's use Zoom,
that's
which
good.
Is one of the, you know, and that's one of the things I'm grateful for, that we have Zoom. That's one of my things I'm going to say on Zoom when it's my turn to speak at the table. I am grateful for Zoom because at least we have a way to get together and to see each other and to share what we are grateful for. And we're having Thanksgiving in our respective homes. I'm making it for my daughter and my ex-husband, so there's three of us. And each of the families of the four families that I have, four children that are alive, are going to, and I say that because I lost one.
I'm sorry
they're
going to
have it at their homes and with their own immediate families, and they're going to do the same process. We're going to get on Zoom at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we're going to go around the table at my daughter's house, and we're going to each say what we're grateful for and eat our own food. So, you know, sometimes you have to be able to accept what you can't change. You change what you can, and if you can't change it, you're going to have to accept it. This is something that's out of our control. And right now, the cases now are over 12 million, or almost 12 million, and there's over 250,000 deaths. So I, for one, cannot take a risk and go out. That's my choice, and my ex-husband's also. And my children feel the same way, but there are many people that don't feel that way, and the thing is not to be judgmental and to have respect for each individual, the way of handling it, and not to make people feel bad about it or critical about it, or let them do what they want to do. So if one person wants to join the family and the other member of the marriage or the couple says, I'm really too scared, one might be pregnant and the other one, the husband, is not pregnant, so he says, well, I'm going to go spend some time with my mother's family, my parents' family, and you stay home. That's another way of handling it, that you can split it up for the couple hours of Thanksgiving if you really feel unsafe and insecure. And if you're in love and you care about each other, you're going to support each other's decisions, whatever it is. You can agree to disagree. That was a real long talk. I apologize.
Well, but no, but it's a great point. And those examples are really quite stationed at this time of year. And again, if you're just tuning into New England Lifestyles here at Radio.com in Boston, I'm Mike Mullaney, and we are talking to a relationship expert and psychotherapist. Her name is Joan Childs, and she's the author of a new book called I Hate the Man I Love, A Conscious Relationship is Your Key to Success. JoanEChilds.com is the website. I saw a statistic, quote on TV last night that really caught my attention. It said, if you insist on having a big family dinner at Thanksgiving, you'll all get together again for someone's funeral on New Year's.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
I saw that and I was like, holy moly, that is really something else. But, you know, the reality is it really is dangerous. And even though we are coming to a point where it looks like we can see the light at the end of the tunnel with, you know, some of these vaccines getting ready to go in the spring, it is still a scary time. And people, you know, look, it is not easy.
No, absolutely. Listen, it's better to lose a family Thanksgiving than to lose a family member. That's how I look at it. So, of course, I'm coming from a person that's 81 years old with a lot of life experiences. Younger people may not feel the same way. They have a different perspective. Everyone has a different perception. You see a car accident, believe me, you're going to get three different perceptions, three
that's
different
true.
Responses. So you have to respect the differences and negotiate the differences to the best that you can without criticism, without contempt, without judgment, and without stonewalling. So it depends the level of health, the relational maturity that you have in a relationship. Believe me, if your relationship was dysfunctional or contentious before Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving is just an excuse at this point. It's much deeper than Thanksgiving, whether to go or not to go.
I remember earlier this year, beginning of the year, it was ironic that Netflix had a movie called A Marriage Story, which I said to myself, that's insane. It should be called Divorce Story, because it was really a brutal film about a divorce. And I remember watching it and thinking, well, there's under no circumstances will I ever get a divorce. And then luckily I have not done so. But then we go into a year where people are cooped up, forced to contend with each other, and being much more close to each other than ever before. So the chances for conflict go through. And then there's a political election, which really separates folks to a level which, you know, my wife blocked me on Facebook because she thought that I was getting too political. And I was like, I get that. And then, you know, the debate about Black Lives Matter versus we support our police became, there's never been a year of more people spending time close together, combined with the fact that some of the most contentious arguments where there are distinctive sides have been crazed. I mean, what do you think we can do in this case?
Well, you're very right. It has been the most divisive year of our lives, my life for sure, and I've been living a lot longer on the planet than a lot of people. But in 81 years of living on the planet, I have never, ever been faced or never been subjected to such divisiveness. In view of what's been going on between the election and COVID and all of the trials and tribulations that we are confronted with, that we're challenged with in these unprecedented times, you think about the children who are at home on top of mother and dad, not being able to have their own social events, being isolated. This is not a human, it's not part of what we need as human beings. We are social. We need each other. But when you don't have your own space and you don't have your own time, your own autonomy, it can become extremely frustrating with everybody. You know, it's kind of like a bunch of gutter rats that are biting each other, even in the best of relationships. So we have to be very, this is where a conscious relationship comes in and a secure attachment. You have to remember, you know, what is most important, what really matters. And it's really the connection that you have with each other. It's the love that you're building on. And to be able to get through this together, that we're all in it together, every one of us. Some of us are better off than others, and some of us are much worse off. And we have to have empathy for those of us who are suffering worse than we are. And we have to have gratitude for those of us who have better lives, because not just because of what's happening, but because we're in a better position, either financially, health-wise, more mature, more understandable, more compassionate. These are the things that really matter. And eventually, like you said earlier in the show, this too will pass. They're going to have a vaccine shortly, and we can look forward to next Thanksgiving, where we can all be back together celebrating unitedly and with each other, family, and making up for the rough year that we've had between the election and the pandemic.
And again, you made that, you talk about having a conscious relationship. What is the key to being in a conscious relationship?
The conscious relationship means that you really have to know who you are. You have to be able to own your own stuff. You know, when you make a mistake, you're able to and recognize it and not defend it or not rationalize it. Just say, yeah, I was wrong. I'm sorry. And I hope you'll forgive me. It's a simple thing. I mean, it's something we learned in kindergarten, you know, to do unto others as others you would have others do unto you. We forget it along the road of life, but it's really to be aware of our own weaknesses and our own shadow side, our dark side, because it's part of the human experience, is we all have a dark side, to embrace it and not to defend it. And to be able to say, I'm sorry when you make a mistake, rather than, you know, rationalize or defend, get defensive. That's what a conscious relationship is like. And when you have one with yourself first, then you can have one with your partner. I hope that was clear.
No, it was indeed. Well, again, relationship expert, psychotherapist Joan Childs. The book is I Hate the Man I Love. You can go to joanechilds.com to find out more about that and just about, you know, how to improve your relationships in general. There's a lot there, and you've been doing it for a long time. So I really appreciate your perspective on things.
I want to say one last thing before we get off the air. Okay.
Yeah.
Ladies, if you ever thought of leaving the man that you love, the same one who can drive you to orgasm and anger in the same day, this book is essential reading. And thank you so much, Mike, for giving me the opportunity to be on your radio show.
No problem at all. I appreciate your time, Joan. Thanks.
Okay. Have a good day and be safe.
You too. Once again, here at Radio.com in Boston, I'm Mike Mullaney. The show is New England Lifestyles, and we talk about a whole bunch of things. And, you know, we're coming up to the holidays this year, and, you know, one of the things that seems to be lost is gratitude because, you know, we've been under a lot of stresses, and, you know, sometimes those stresses just jump up at you. Good example. This morning, I'm doing another interview, and because everyone's remote, all of a sudden someone logs in remotely and kicks me off the interview, and everything I had recorded gets bounced. And I'm like, what is going on here? I don't like this year. Joining me on the phone right now is Carrie Cannon. She is an international best-selling author, founder of HealingCenter.com. Why are we so frustrated, and why don't we have all the gratitude we need, Carrie?
Hey, Mike, thank you so much for having me on. Well, you know, honestly, it comes down to we don't understand, actually, who we are and why gratitude is important in our lives. So just so you know a little bit about me, my background, my focus has always been on more self-realization. And the more I grow, the more I realize that my entire experience is actually myself. Like, I can't separate myself from my life. I can't separate myself from every moment of now that I'm experiencing. And the more that I grow, the more that I realize that I am this life. And when we practice gratitude, what that does is it actually activates the universe to catalyze change on our behalf. And since we're not taught this as kids or whatever, we don't realize how much power we have. And when we say yes to something and we're excited about something, the universe actually goes forth and aligns things for us. And that's why it's so important to practice, because it's actually the activating mechanism for all good things.
I tell you something. We do fundamentally forget how lucky we are to be where we are, regardless of what the challenges are. I mean, I always remember that scene from The Simpsons where Mo from, you know, Moe's Tavern says to Homer, "I've got a deep fryer here that'll deep fry a buffalo in 45 seconds. And Homer says, 45 seconds? I want it now.
Yeah.
It's like, really? You can't wait 45 seconds. Really? You're having a hard time. You're safe. You're in an environment where even when you're quarantined, you have access to streaming features, most of us. You have food most of the time. You might not have toilet paper. That's a second issue. But there are many, many things that we can, you know, we can be grateful for. You know, being caught up
absolutely
in the moment of what we don't have, it's easy to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the more we think about the things that we don't have, the more we sort of attract that into our lives, right? Like, that's sort of basic law of attraction. And the thing is, our society is so focused on the material, whatever is going on. And if we could just take a moment and sort of become connected to ourselves, there is no time. Like, I've gone through, you know, really, really hard times, like seemingly harder than what, you know, is going on now. And I've freaked out. You know, we've all freaked out. But the fact of the matter is, and the truth is, that we're always okay. We're always okay. And I think we forget that. And then, you know, there are many people that have it a lot harder than we do. You know, people who are lining up for soup kitchens, who have mental health issues that, you know, that aren't getting them addressed, and, you know, who've lost, you know, have gone through devastation. And we lose sight that, you know, when we're sort of, like you said, living our life, even though we might be quarantined or living in a time of COVID, you know, for the most part, we're okay. We're being taken care of. And to practice a little bit of gratitude helps us to get our mindset out of our sort of, you know, self-absorption, which we all experience that. But when we can do that, it allows us to open up to better and greater things because it allows possibilities.
You know, it's funny that you said that, the whole idea of, you know, it's always going to be about us. And it's hard to sometimes get out of ourselves. You know, it's like, you know, no matter where you go, there you are. And the idea, though, that just now I vented about a frustrating situation at work. You know, I can't log into the computers. The fact is that I have a job, and we are experiencing a time where we've had more unemployment than we've had in years. So instead of being frustrated with the situation, how thankful should I be the fact that I'm actually working right now? You know, there are so many little things where you can say to yourself, well, don't obsess about what is wrong. Take a look at what's right. And that whole idea of the law of attraction, you know, for those who don't understand what that law of attraction is, if you obsess about what's wrong, that is what you will feel. If you really extenuate the positive and look for the positive, you'll see things you didn't even know were there.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, so in the work that I do, it's sort of like beyond law of attraction, because I've been, you know, focusing on my self-development for so long, going on like 30 years. And because of the perspective that I have on life, that, you know, my life is me, I approach things from that perspective. And when I'm doing something like calling in something for somebody, I use prayers of gratitude. So my work is focused on enlightenment and gratitude. And what I do in my work is I'll actually call things in on behalf of other people, and they see that these amazing things start happening. So, for example, I had I was doing a podcast at one point, and this gentleman who was a struggling artist, and, you know, like, you're a struggling artist, you're not making very much money. He listened to this podcast, and he wanted for his life to change and for his work to get out in a better way. And within 6 weeks, he called me and he said, "Carrie, you know what happened after I listened to that prayer of gratitude that you did on that podcast?" He said, "Within 6 weeks, I was asked to do a solo art exhibit in Portugal, one in the Maldives, and somebody asked me to submit one of my artworks to be on permanent display at the Louvre in Paris."
What?
And it's all because of gratitude. Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Oh, holy moly.
Yeah. And yesterday I got a testimonial from somebody, because I do these monthly calls, and she said just from listening to my calls, just out of the blue, like out of the clear blue, she got $5,000, just not expecting it, just landed in her lap. And it's all because of the gratitude practice that, you know, I teach people about.
And again,
so, yeah.
And if you're just tuning in, gratitude expert and life coach Carrie Cannon, international bestselling author, founder of HealingCenter.com. You've been a featured guest on NBC, PBS, a whole bunch of places. If you really want to change your circumstances, what would you say is the single most effective practice for doing that? What can we do today to help us change the mindset and, you know, our circumstance?
So there are a couple things. So something that I personally will do is I'll look at a circumstance that I might be struggling with, having a challenge with. And obviously, so challenges are the universe asking us to pivot and to go in a different direction because something's not working, right? So what I will do is I will look at the situation, maybe write it all out, and then say, okay, what is it in my life that would make this all totally worth it? Like, what could potentially happen that could come out of this that would make it so worth it? And then what I'll do is I'll start focusing on that and start thanking the universe for that thing happening. But, you know, sometimes, Mike, we're not always in a place where we can do that. And so honestly, and this is just because this is what I do, and I get testimonials all the time, also listening to a consciousness alignment, which is what I call the work that I do, because what it does is it aligns people on their behalf when they've been working on it for so long and they can't get out of their own way. What that does is it sort of calls in reinforcements and helps people to shift a lot more quickly.
What would be
but
like an example
of like
that?
And also probably volunteer work. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, give us an example of that. You mentioned volunteer work. I mean, there are a lot of little examples, but sometimes, you know, doing these examples where we talk about a specific situation or a person went through is a good way so people can understand exactly how we're putting this into action.
Yeah. So like I said, like that example with the struggling artist, I also had, when I first started doing this work, I had I was asking for guinea pigs because I discovered that it was a possibility, because the stuff that I do is like way outside of everybody's box, like even mine. I'm like, holy mackerel, this is a possibility. And so when I first started doing it, I was asking for guinea pigs. And one of the people who I was writing a book with, which was then became that number one best-selling book, she said, you know, I have a couple things that I would like. I would like for our book to be a bestseller, and I would like to heal my relationship with my daughter. And so I was like, well, you know, that's nice that you want the book to be a bestseller, but how about a number one international bestseller? And she was like, can we do that? I said, we can put it out there. So that's what we did. And then with her daughter was just sort of going through a time in her life where she had just graduated from high school. She was sort of laying around the house doing not very much of anything, and she was driving her mother crazy, and she also had a shopping habit. So her mother was like, listen, you're either going to need to get a job or, you know, go on the dole, because I cannot afford to support your lifestyle. And so as an 18-year-old, what she did was, you know, she got public assistance. And so it put even a bigger wedge in her relationship with her mother. And then I said, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to align her so that her dream job just lands in her lap. She doesn't have to do anything. And she's going to be so happy with herself, and that it's going to spill over into her relationship with you. How does that sound? And my friend was like, that sounds awesome. So that's what we did. We aligned her for that. So a couple weeks later, we were talking about the book, and she said, I have to tell you what happened with my daughter. So she's in her favorite boutique, spending her check, and the shop owner approaches her and says, hey, how would you like to be a model for our internet and print presence? You'll get paid, you will be able to start a portfolio, and you'll get a discount. And so, boom, dream job, check, you know, 18-year-old. So there was that, and then, I love the story because it's a twofer, and then our book, it took a little longer because we had rewrites and we had other things that we needed to do, but on American Thanksgiving 2014, our book, Embraced by the Divine, The Emerging Woman's Gateway to Power, Passion, and Purpose, went to number one in the United States, Canada, Australia, the UK, and the Netherlands. So, like, it's through these prayers of gratitude. It's through gratitude. So, you know, there's your example of what can happen, and it's so specific when it happens. It's so specific to exactly what you ask for, if you ask for it in the right way.
Well, again, Carrie Cannon, healingcenters.com. Do us one thing before you get out of here. What is a simple way tomorrow morning we can get up and start a gratitude habit? Give us a shot.
So when you wake up, you know, you may think of all the troubles that you have throughout the day, but try and pivot that and think of the best thing that can possibly happen. And then when you have that thought, just say out loud, thank you, thank you, thank you. That's what I want. And you'll see that your life will little by little start changing in that positive direction.
That's good stuff. Again, gratitude expert, consciousness coach, Carrie Cannon. Appreciate your time. This website again, healingcenter.com. Have a great holiday, Carrie.
You too. Thanks so much, Mike.
Joining us on the line right now is Chris Voss. He's written a book called Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Chris, first off, I want to give you kudos because there aren't many books which start off with your child being taken hostage. Kind of wild.
Yeah, my brother at Harvard, Bob Mnookin, thought he had me there, didn't he?
But the way this book is written is a wonderful read because you always present these situations which are so compelling to set up each one of the points you make. So kudos to you.
Thank you very much. We try to make the book fun to read and interesting so that it wouldn't be your typical boring business book.
Well, it's definitely not that. So take us a little bit through this. So you're a former FBI hostage negotiator, and, you know, you're saying that you can split it, you know, negotiate anything. And, you know, it's funny, you think negotiating, you think only the, you know, in negotiating a contract or something. But we're constantly negotiating, whether it be in business, whether it be at our work, whether it be at our family. Talk a little bit about the idea of how many different ways negotiations can kind of present themselves.
Yeah, I got to tell you, if yes is in the air, if somebody's trying to get you to say yes, or you're trying to get somebody else to say yes, you're in a negotiation. I mean, the most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. In many cases, the other side will be negotiating with you before you even know it. So you probably in four or five negotiations yesterday, at least. So it's becoming aware of it, and then just becoming aware of how you can influence it. Actually, by getting out of the yes dynamic, get into a how dynamic.
Well, talk a little bit about that. Give me an example of a conversation which you might not even realize is a negotiation, which suddenly becomes one.
I want to get a artificial Christmas tree for the holidays.
That's pretty good.
Or you know, a significant other you love very much, and she wants a real tree. Or somebody's trying to negotiate with you at work to get you to comply, because mostly we think negotiations involve money, where in fact most negotiations don't involve money. They involve time, the most valuable commodity after all this time. The line from the movie Wall Street 2, the only line that I liked in that whole movie, was how important time is. And any time somebody's trying to get your time, somebody's trying to get you to walk down the hall to talk to somebody else in your office to help convince them to do something, you know, that's a negotiation, getting you to walk down the hall, getting you to take their side. Anytime somebody's trying to get you to do anything, you're in a negotiation. So, yeah, they happen to us every day.
So when I'm talking to my kids at night, and my kid's like, Dad, can I just watch the last five minutes of the show? You're suddenly already engaged in this negotiation.
Right. And, you know, and the first thing that you do every time your kid asks you something is say no. I mean, even before they finish the question. And interestingly enough, as soon as you said no immediately, they keep talking and maybe even talk you into it. And that was because saying no makes us feel protected. We feel like we're in charge. Our kids do this to us all the time. They trigger a no, and then they keep going. So you can use that dynamic in your business interactions. Don't be scared of no. Understand when the other side says no, maybe that opens them up to continue the negotiation.
And it really comes down to the fact that interpersonal relationships and interpersonal communications always come down to some form of negotiation or another. You know, in this book, you talk about how a failed hostage negotiation forced you to reevaluate the FBI negotiation strategy. Tell me how that happened.
Well, you know, we did everything that we knew how to do. I mean, I was running a program at the time, and I knew right up to when things went bad. And actually, the hostages that got killed were killed in a botched rescue attempt. We just happened to think they were going to come out sooner. If we did everything we knew how to do, then I just felt like we got to get better. We got to learn more. And that's really when I started looking outside, and I ended up at Harvard Law School's negotiation course. And when I went through that, we just decided we were doing the same stuff. I mean, my professors that I learned from there, they saw it before I did. We were hostage negotiation, business negotiation, same strategy, same dynamics, just different stakes.
It's kind of amazing because over the course of your time with the FBI, you were involved with over 150 kidnapping cases, all kinds of stuff. It has to be pretty intense, but it's amazing that the negotiation techniques that are used in those situations really kind of translate themselves. But, I mean, when you were doing this kind of stuff, it has to be amazing to have so many people's lives in your hands when you're doing something like that. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, trying to get yourself in a place where you just saw these as negotiations, and, you know, when somebody's life is in your hand, it can get you rattled, and you can be rattled, and the other side's not the least bit rattled. And coming to understand that what the other guy was feeling was a lot more important than I was feeling made me a better hostage negotiator, makes you a better business negotiator. I mean, kidnappers are businessmen. They're international commodities dealers, and they only care about getting paid. I mean, that sounds like a lot of people out there, right? So once you understand that how the other side feels about this is a lot more important than how you feel, actually, you gain a huge advantage.
We're on the line with Chris Voss, who's the author of the book Never Split the Difference, an amazingly well-read and compelling book, which just talks about the reality of negotiating. And negotiating is everywhere in our lives. And he kind of gives you ideas on how you can, you know, get the upper hand in negotiations. You have a whole bunch of counterintuitive techniques and strategies that you contend give anyone a competitive edge. What are some of those things we can do to gain an upper hand in a negotiation, Chris?
We'll be a lot more willing to ask how. I mean, the great way of saying no, I mean, the magical way to say no, is how am I supposed to do that? And saying that horrifies us on a regular basis because we're scared the other side is going to say, well, because you have to. Well, actually, that's ultimately where you want to get, but it's probably going to take you two or three times to say that. When they say because you have to, you know you push them as far as you can. But it's the art of pushing the other side as far as you can without pushing them away from the table, because they're still in negotiation at that point in time. Now, what will happen the first time or two you say, how am I supposed to do that, is they're going to stop, and they're going to think, and they're going to hesitate, and they're going to concede. and you're going to find more space and you're going to find better deals. So that's one of the real keys, being much more willing to say how, because we're afraid that we lay ourselves open, when in fact what we've done is box the other side in.
That's pretty interesting. One of the things in one of the chapters of the book is called Beware Yes and Master No. Now, obviously, you're asking, you know, them to say, you know, explain how I'm supposed to do that. But the yes and no stuff, why is it so important to, you know, beware saying yes and really mastering how to say no?
Well, people try to take us hostage with yes every single day. I mean, this whole nonsense about the yes momentum and, you know, get people to say yes to a lot of little things in a row and they'll say yes to the big thing. I mean, we get that pulled on us every day 4 or 5 times. If I say to you, do you want to make more money? I mean, that's a setup yes. You know that I got something in mind. And you've immediately got your guard up. So getting out of that dynamic is really huge, and also stopping doing it to other people immediately changes the dynamic as well.
One of the things you talk about is bending the other side's reality. Talk about that and how that works, not only in big picture, but also in the little picture. Like I personally am right now, my daughter has been texting me all morning. She wants a dog, and she wants me to come home early today, and I've already told her I cannot, and she's continuing to push. So I'm like, wow, I'm already in a negotiation this morning.
Well, you are, and bending reality is about understanding how much the fear of loss distorts our perception. I mean, it's the closest thing to an academic principle that I pulled in, because this is a practitioner's book. I mean, this book is designed to help you start getting better and making a difference immediately. But fear of loss is huge, and it's actually a Nobel Prize-winning behavioral economics concept, in that loss thinks twice as much as an equivalent gain. So if I can pose something as a loss, there's a pretty good chance that I'm going to change your mind a lot quicker than if I propose it as a gain. Loss just stings us so much harder. It's actually almost dangerously powerful once you wrap your mind around that.
I know that you're always a big advocate of bargaining hard. And, you know, one of those situations is people sometimes forget that they're in the upper hand in a situation. A good example of that is if you're going to buy a new car. You're the one who's going to make this gigantic purchase. The person you're talking to at those dealerships, they're not the ones who, you know, they need your business. So they need you. And people go in feeling weak in those situations. You always talk about bargaining hard in this book. Talk about how that manifests itself in a variety of different ways.
Well, yeah, and you bargain hard with a tactical application of empathy. And I know empathy makes people fall asleep, and that's why we talk about it in a tactical way. I mean, let's understand, if I articulate your position before you articulate it, I leave you with nothing to say. And so when I bought my truck, I'm so in love with my salsa red pearl Toyota SUV. I mean, it's the sexiest color you ever saw. I fell in love with it from the moment I saw it. And instead of having a salesman tell me, you know, you love this car, you think it's beautiful, I said, look, I got to tell you something. I love this truck. This is the most beautiful truck, and it is worth way more than what I'm going to offer you for it. And here's my offer. That left him with nowhere to go. I'd taken away all of his arguments, and I bargained really hard by tactically articulating what it was that he was going to say before he said it. Left him nowhere to go.
In the course of your time, you've negotiated with some of the toughest folks there are in horrendous situations. What are some of the? Can you pinpoint one particular time where you just said this is one of the toughest negotiations and you still came out okay?
Well, we had a serial kidnapper, serial killer that had kidnapped a guy in the Philippines. And we didn't know just how dangerous and deadly this guy was at the time. You know, I had a feeling we were dealing with someone who was a really dangerous adversary. And, you know, he kind of used a classic CEO jargon with us, too. A decision maker, when you talk to a decision maker on the phone, a real important person on the other side, they're going to say we, they, and them all the time. They use plural pronouns. You can't get them to go I, me, my to save their life because they know how it evades decision-making, and this guy did that. You know, so he was a really dangerous guy, and he always talked about the rest of the group and how dangerous everybody else was. And when we asked him an open-ended question that got him to completely drop his guard so much that he literally said over the phone, under his breath, wow, nobody ever dealt with me like this before. And we had the upper hand, and he was a killer, and we got our hostage out.
Pretty amazing stuff. Again, the book, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Again, one of the best reads I've had in such a long time because you use so many great examples. And, dude, you've been through some crazy stuff.
Well,
seriously.
Yeah. It was a wild ride, and we wrote the book to make it a fun and interesting read that you could apply right away. I mean, I wanted you to be able to read this book and enjoy it, you know, not have it suck the life out of you like reading a dictionary, but actually be able to apply it and make a difference right away.
Well, again, you're now the founder and principal owner of the Black Swan Group, a consulting firm. It's going to be a great thing to not only have a thriving company and understand the negotiation. Every time someone comes in and say, hey, I need to hire you, you know how to bring that. But the book itself, just such a great read. Again, Chris Voss, Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. Thank you so much for joining us here in Boston today. Great stuff, and I really encourage anyone to read this. It's such a fun read.
Thanks, Mike. A pleasure being on with you.
Again, here at Radio.com in Boston, Mike Mullaney's the name. Radio, let me try that again. There's a weird sound in my studio. Again, here at Radio.com in Boston, I'm Mike Mullaney on New England Lifestyles. And look, we've been talking about this election for so long, speculating about what would happen, how things could fall out. We talked a little bit about the Electoral College. But here we are a couple of weeks after the election, and we still don't have a concession speech. We don't have a transition team between the two administrations, and there's all kinds of contention about voting. So we wanted to bring our friend back in, attorney Richard Bell, author of the new book, Voting, the Ultimate Act of Resistance. Perfect time for this book, right?
Oh, absolutely. I did time this one well because it falls into all of the categories that you just mentioned.
Now, so much is going on here. So first and foremost, we know that in the vote, Joe Biden did win the election. He won by over 5 million votes, and he won the Electoral College 306 to 232 approximately. There were some recounts, but here we stand, and there's still legal challenges. So why do we still have these challenges? Because just about every lawsuit that's been filed by the Trump administration has been thrown out. So where are we at and what are we watching?
Okay, I think what we're watching is a power-thirsty wackadoodle. That's the legal term I'll use, who has no respect for democracy or the will of the people. Because let's start with the lawsuits. The lawsuits are clearly just a pretext for what they want to do next, which is we'll get into about what they want to do with the Electoral College. Because the lawsuits have gone absolutely nowhere throughout the states. I think there's something like 35 or so post-election suits, and Trump is something like 2 for 33. So that batting average is .060. He'd get benched or cut if this were baseball, right? So it's going nowhere. Yeah, so the lawsuits are a pretext because every judge they go before says the same thing. You've got evidence of the fraud? No. Okay, what are you doing here? So that's basically where it always goes.
And one of the things that we've seen is that, you know, there have been, if you follow the internet, this is going to shock you, Richard, but the internet is full of phony baloney stories. You know, you see the story of, you know, 500 people who were dead voted in Michigan, when in reality, that wasn't the case.
Not
the only
true.
Person who did was a person who supported Trump who voted for his dead mother. So that was the only case. So we keep seeing these things where, you know, evidence is shown, well, look at, I have a post-it note that says I don't feel that this is going the right way. Well, that is not evidence. That is, you know, there are so many things that you have to provide, but one of the key things is proof. And there hasn't been any thus far. But the thing is, half the people in this country, you know, 78 million voted for Biden, 72 million voted for Trump, and a good chunk of the Trump supporters firmly believe that there has been election fraud when, in fact, there has not been any, which creates a really strange point.
Yeah, I don't know if you're old enough to remember Jim Jones, but he's the one where drinking the Kool-Aid comes from because he had a cult and they had, unfortunately, a horrible mass suicide of 1,000 people. It's a cult-like thinking. But let's go beyond that because we're not here today to change the minds of 71 million people.
100%.
Right? We just need to get to the facts.
So here we are. The thing we're hearing is it's about certifying votes. What does that even mean, Richard?
Okay, so in every state, after the votes are counted by the counties, then the votes are certified. In most instances, it's the Secretary of State of the state, and they certify it, which means they say, okay, these are the county counts. We've looked this over. This is accurate. We now certify it, which means we're going to say who the winner is and by how much. And they have these various deadlines. Georgia starts with today. And just for the states that really count at this point, it runs through Wisconsin on December 1st and a few others in between, Arizona, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan. So certified means that the Secretary of State says this is what the actual vote was. Why is that important? Because Trump has been trying to stop the certification. He keeps losing every time he tries because there's no evidence as to why it should stop. And once it's certified, you can still have election contests in court up until, we'll get to this date of December 8th, but up until that point, you can still have these contests in court. Of course, everything we've seen so far in court is a big goose egg. So there's nothing coming. If nothing's come by now, then nothing's coming. Come on, that would be ridiculous. As a lawyer, I look at it and say, okay, this is not law. This is some political strategy because every judge has thrown everything out.
Well, let me ask you this very quickly. One of the things is we saw Supreme Court Justice Alito get involved for some reason, and he's made a bunch of odd statements. Why do you think the motivation for that is when there's clearly nothing in court which is that really needs to be commented on? Is that unprecedented for a Supreme Court justice to just insert himself into something like this?
Well, he actually was not saying anything about fraud. What he was saying in a dissent was that in Pennsylvania, when the state court had extended the time within which to count ballots that were vote-by-mail ballots that were received within 3 days after Election Day, but postmarked by Election Day, his comment was, that doesn't sound constitutional to me, but it's too late because it's too close to the election. Let's assume for a moment that case really ended up getting decided by the Supreme Court. Who cares? Biden's up by 80,000 votes, and the number of votes that fit in that category is approximately 10,000. It would make absolutely no difference, even if the Supreme Court did something like that and ruled like that, even after they told the voters of Pennsylvania, it's okay, those are the rules of the game, but we're going to change them now. So it wouldn't even make a difference on the result of the election.
All right, so let's get back to certification. One of the biggest points is in Michigan, and we heard that Trump is now attempting to bring in people from the state to have a meeting about certification. What is that all about? And it almost seems like he's trying to subvert the will of the people there. It seems like an exceptionally unusual and probably, isn't it illegal to do something like this?
Yeah, I'll tell you, if I were the Republican leaders of the Senate and the House in Michigan, I'd be real careful about taking this meeting because if there's something dangled like an ambassadorship or a cabinet post or something like that, you're probably committing a crime. So I'd be real careful with them. They said they're just there to listen. It's very clear from common sense, forget about the law, what's really going on there. And yes, it is unprecedented.
And so what do we think is, I mean, the end game is clear here. One of the biggest points that I find so shocking is that we're in the middle of this pandemic and sharing information with an incoming administration is so vital because when that administration starts at 12 noon on January 20th, they need to be ready to hit the ground running with plans and execution and stuff like that. The idea of impeding that, it just seems to be, people say that he's just digging his heels in to be, you know, to make it more difficult. It's hard to understand why this is going on.
Well, it's not hard if you think about the fact that he almost never mentions the 250,000 souls that have lost their lives to the pandemic. And his lack of empathy and care is very well documented at this point. And he only cares about himself. I don't think that's a controversial statement. And I think we need to understand in terms of the transition money. That's what this is about. The General Services Administration turning over the money so that we can get this going. You know, democracy, I look at democracy as both a legal and a moral compact, right, between the citizens and the government. So legally, the federal law states that the transition money can be turned over when the result of the election is apparent. Well, that is an ambiguous term. It has never been an ambiguous term before because we're all part of that social compact. We understand our country has to run smoothly and transition is what happens in a democracy peacefully. But that's what's going on now. It's kind of spite. It's awful. We're talking about spite that ruins or kills people in the midst of a pandemic. It's disgusting.
Well, let me ask you this. Has any state in history not certified the votes in an election?
I am not aware of any state not certifying. There was a time in 1876 when competing elector slates were sent to Congress. But the year after that, they passed a law that's still in effect now, the Electoral Count Act, that would address that. And I think that's one of the things that Trump is looking at. And they're saying, well, the Electoral Count Act does say that if it's a failed election in your state, then the legislature can go and instead of the governor and bring an electoral slate forward. You know, the term failed election has never been interpreted. Nobody has got to that point. And if his argument is it's a failed election because there was widespread fraud, then how come every court that it's been before said no? So it's not it's beyond a weak legal argument.
And so the idea that, you know, the Electoral College could be, because we heard saying, you know, you just because the election results came out in these states, the electors don't necessarily have to vote for the person who won the election. Every time I hear that, I say, don't they?
Well, that's yeah. So here's what it is in English without getting into the weeds. Every state legislature has a right to make its own rules regarding its electoral votes. And every state before the election, which is what counts, and you can't do it after the election, make it retroactive. Every state, it says, the popular vote winner will get the Electoral College slate. And obviously, Maine and Nebraska have that one congressional district. But that is the law. So under this Trump theory, the legislatures, after the rules of the game have been set, would have to say, yeah, that was before, but now that we lost, we want to change it. And that is just a zero on a legal theory.
Ultimately, you know, we hear about voter suppression, and we know that that is a reality. It has been a reality in the past. The idea that some of the places targeted are, you know, like Wayne County in Michigan, this almost smacks of being a voter suppression case as well.
Oh, it doesn't smack of it, and it's not some of the counties. Let's get right to the point. It's always predominantly African-American cities. It's Philadelphia. It's Detroit. It's Milwaukee. It was Atlanta. 100%. When I do my work, I worked for 2 decades, and I wrote that book, Voting the Ultimate Act of Resistance. It's about my experience working against voter suppression at polling places and in the courts over the last 2 decades. This year is the ultimate in voter suppression because you want to overturn the election. And basically, he wants to say wherever majority areas of African Americans who turned the election, their states voted for me, we should throw out their votes. That's the simple way of saying it.
That's pretty crazy stuff. So what do voters need to know moving ahead about the elections? We see all these cases and stuff like that. Is our system broken, or is this just a gasp of trying to make it appear to be as such?
Okay, number one, I want to reassure your audience that Joe Biden is going to be sworn in at noon on January 20th. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on right now. But for those who have some high anxiety at this moment, I think they should be able to calm down because that is how it's going to end. Like everything else with Trump, there's a lot of bluster and there's a lot of distraction, but it will end the right way. So let's get that out of the way so people can sleep tonight. In terms of in the future, yes, what happened was both the Founding Fathers and the Congress, when they came up with that Electoral Count Act in 1887 and amended it over the years, we never really thought in terms of someone with these kind of dictatorial tendencies who would want to overturn the will of the people in elections. So the answer would be yes, we should clearly tighten the laws. The second issue is, with the divided government we have and with the Republican Party as it is right now, which is basically the cult of Trump, is that going to happen? The best we could hope for is it happens within the state legislatures.
I tell you, though, it does certainly indicate, though, that it shows the divide in this country where so many people are so adamant on each of the sides. I mean, is this more real political divide, or is it more about that cult of personality that it seems to be, coalescing around Trump with his followers?
Well, we think at this point it's the cult of personality, but the enablers in the Republican Party are clearly drawing the line in the sand and saying this is the Republican Party. It is Trump's Republican Party. And I think we need to remember, because it gets confused, I understand why, with all the bustle and every 3 seconds things are changing. But I think we have to remember we could be divided on political policies and points of view. We should never be divided on whether we want to have a democracy or a dictatorship. And a democracy means the rule of law is the final say. And the kinds of things that are being done right now, both what he's doing in the courts with frivolous lawsuits and his threat with legislatures, this is not the rule of law. This is not democracy. And this certainly is not abiding by the will of the people.
Well, I tell you, politics is never boring. It's been one of the more interesting stretches. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. But, you know, and the interesting part about this is that for anyone who thinks, you know, on January 20th, it's all over, the reality is that the amount of support and the passion for Donald Trump among supporters, and again, this interview is not meant from my perspective to be a bashing session. It's just about to talk about the issues as they stand today. If you support Donald Trump, hallelujah, do your thing. You know, you're 100%, that's well within your rights, and I encourage anyone who wants to vote that way to vote that way. You know, the same thing with Biden. It's not about taking a political side. It's more about the fact that we're talking about something that seems exceptionally off in the way this transition or lack of transition has been happening and how the votes. But, you know, because this is the outside of 2000, we have never seen this long without a concession speech, have we?
No. And the concession speech, that's nice, but it's not necessary. I mean, who cares if he does it or not? It's not the legally required of him. So if he wants to be a poor sport, look, you've played sports. There were some poor sports. They don't want to shake your hand. Fine. You still won the game.
Right.
So we can't worry about that. What he has done, and I agree with you, it is fine to have a different point of view in terms of your political policies or perspectives. But when we start having a different point of view as to whether the rule of law applies and whether political norms apply and to whether acts of the legislature or the Congress applies, then we've gone astray from whether we want a democracy or not. That's what I'm saying.
Well, again, it's a great point. And again, RichardCBellEsquire.com is the site, or 877-CALL-LAW.com is a way to get in touch with you. And again, the book, Voting, the Ultimate Act of Resistance. And, you know, we saw there's never been an election where more people took part. And keeping people actively engaged in the voting process is so important to the health of this country. The more people who take part, the more the will of the largest chunk of America will be seen. So, I mean, that's one of those things where we really have to push to make voting easy, to make voting accessible, and to make as many voting locations as possible. You know, people talked about vote by mail and how easy it is to commit fraud with it, but we haven't seen that fraud. So I think this election, in the way it was set up, worked out well this year.
Now, Mike, in terms of those allegations of fraud, before this election, every major study showed it is infinitesimal. It is never been widespread. Has never affected the national elections, or all the vast majority of any local elections. This election, it's gotten tested in the courts. It's not just some kind of study. This election looks like a completely clean, fair, free election where the most Americans in history came out, which is absolutely fantastic. And I agree with you. We need to build on this, because the more we all participate, the more we have a country that represents the will of the people.
Well, again, voting rights expert and attorney Richard C. Bell, the book Voting, the Ultimate Act of Resistance. I appreciate your passion and time and your knowledge, sir. It is great talking to you.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you for having me back, Michael.